commemorate and celebrate African American history and culture. Most of these institutions were founded in the years after the American Civil War, but Howard University was also among those threatened on Tuesday. The White House said it is taking the threat seriously, but added that it is still unclear what could have motivated those threats. However, the issue is not an isolated one, as the U.S. intelligence last year warned about racially motivated possible attacks by extremists, such as white supremacists.
HBCUs, like many other institutions in the Black community, become targets when issues of race, issues of civil rights, issues of equality bubble to the surface and become the focal point of American society. Whenever African Americans begin to kind of push for rights, push for recognition, our institutions have then been targeted by those who seek to silence those voices.
The threats come as the United States remains a fertile ground for injustice, with the country being criticized for racial profiling, use of excessive force, and discrimination against minorities. The killing of George Floyd in 2020 is one of numerous examples of how African Americans are being treated in a country claimed to be the defender of human rights. Floyd is one among a dozen of recent Black victims that gained global attention and sparked protests at home and abroad against U.S. police brutality. According to a U.S. media report, about 1 in 1,000 African Americans can expect to die at the hands of police in their lifetime, almost double that of their white counterparts.
In each generation, for every several years, there needs to be a major fight in order for Black Americans to win equality and equity in the country. And now at a time when we're starting to see strides happening with more educated Black Americans, Black women are the most educated ethnic group in our country. When we're seeing these strides, we are also seeing a commensurate white lash that we have seen historically whenever Black Americans increase their autonomy, increase their agency, and increase their socioeconomic mobility.
The racism is deep-rooted in the U.S. society, with discrimination being seen institutionalized in both political and economic domains. The attack on Capitol Hill last year was the culmination of the same, as rioters blatantly and proudly carried symbols of hate, meaning the attack had much to do with race in America. In the aftermath, threats against Blacks and people of color became more evident. Repeated threats, shootings, and lack of transparency have already terrorized America's Black community. It is feared that the country may be heading for more unrest and a dangerous divide if the country's leadership and politicians fail to act upon their long-cherished dream of equality.
At 11:30 a.m. Monday, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson received an important email. In the attachment, a damning report into alleged parties under his roof last year. Among other things, a 13-page report by senior civil servant Sue Gray looked at 16 gatherings during the pandemic and found that the behavior was difficult to justify, with failures of leadership and judgment, and too little thought was given to what was happening across the country.
The complete version of the Sue Gray report is yet to be published, pending a police investigation. But the sheer scale of potential breaches meant that Boris Johnson had to face furious MPs in the building in penitent mode. Again.
I want to apologize. I know that millions of people across this country have made extraordinary sacrifices over the last 18 months.
To the opposition, sorry was not enough.
The British public aren't fools. They never believed a word of it. They think the Prime Minister should do the decent thing and resign. Of course he won't, because he is a man without shame.
He has been investigated by the police. He misled the House. He must now resign.
Members of the Prime Minister's own party didn't pull any punches either.
Either my right honourable friend had not read the rules, or didn't understand what they meant, and others around him, or they didn't think the rules applied to number 10. Which was it?
And while the Prime Minister and the people around him were allegedly having a good time away from prying eyes, the rest of the people adhered to the rules. Those who didn't were stopped unceremoniously.
What it would take for this Prime Minister to go, I don't know. If this doesn't get in his way, then God help us all, frankly, in terms of politics in this country.
People are sceptical, and I think a lot of people also kind of think with the police, you know, quite rightly, obviously, number 10, there's a police presence. So people in the police were aware that, or should have been aware that, you know, something was going on in the back garden.
While people were dying and while people were unable to attend funerals, for him to be holding parties and agreeing to parties to be held when he made the rules is fairly immoral.
The public mood here is one of outrage at the moment, but experts say what Boris Johnson desperately needs now is not public support, but the backing of his own party members to avoid a leadership challenge. Saeed Purizep, London.
Yemeni health workers have staged a demonstration inside the Ministry of Health in Yemen's capital Sana'a to warn that over 300 health facilities are on the verge of collapse due to the severe fuel shortage. They slammed the continued detention of Yemeni oil vessels by Saudi Arabia and its allies.
The health sector is suffering greatly due to the lack of fuel, as health officials suffer from a shortage in electrical power generations to save the lives of thousands of patients. Intensive care units, oxygen factories, operation rooms, emergency rooms, and other divisions will stop, and this is a crime against the Yemeni people. Unfortunately, the international community remains silent about what is happening. The United Nations has failed to fulfill its duties.
The Ministry of Health has called on the international community to step in and to pressure the Saudi-led coalition to release the detained oil vessels and save the lives of thousands of Yemeni patients who may lose their lives as a result of the Saudi blockade on the country.
Banning the entry of fuel ships and piracy on Yemeni oil ships lead to a health catastrophe, as hospitals and health centers are in constant need of fuel. The interruption means that health services will stop working. Some patients come from other governorates to get treatment in Sana'a, such as cancer patients, and the fuel crisis will make their transportation even more difficult. We warn of an imminent health disaster and call on the international community to do its part to save the lives of thousands of Yemeni patients, including children.
Recently, the member of Yemen's negotiating delegation, Abdul Malik al-Hajri, passed away of kidney failure as he could not travel abroad for treatment due to the continued closure of Sana'a International Airport that comes as Saudi Arabia and its allies have imposed an all-out blockade on Yemen since March 2015.
The lives of thousands of Yemeni patients, including children, are in danger amid the absence of essential healthcare services. Unfortunately, the inaction of the international community towards the catastrophic situation in Yemen is emboldening the Saudi-led coalition to further continue its crimes in the war-ravaged country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Omani Foreign Minister Badr al-Busaidi met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. The two sides discussed bilateral relations and recent regional developments. During the talks, Assad referred to both countries' mutual understanding of regional issues, asserting that Arabs need to conduct realistic dialogue and set up necessary bases for political relations among each other. He stressed that developments in the Arab world require a change of their political approach. For his part, Busaidi conveyed to Assad greetings of the Omani Sultan, underlining Syria's strong and brave stances in facing regional challenges.
We look forward to strengthening our economic, trade and political relations. I discussed in detail such relations with my Syrian counterpart. There are efforts made by many countries currently to bring Arabs together, correct mistakes of the past, and adopt a more futuristic vision for Arab cooperation in order to overcome the past.
For his part, Syrian Foreign Minister underlined the significance of collaboration with Oman for bringing Arabs together.
The meeting was an opportunity to discuss joint Arab action and solidarity, as well as establishing the best relations among Arab states in order to correct previous mistakes and build the future. Syria and Oman formed together a force for underlining the importance of a united Arab stance to overcome challenges facing our countries and peoples.
Oman has been working for years on alleviating tension between Arab countries, mainly with regards to Syria. He arrived in Damascus coming from Kuwait, where Arab foreign ministers were meeting. The significance of Oman's strategy towards Syria is that it did not sever its ties, as many Arab countries did during the crisis.
The visit comes as Arab countries are gradually restoring relations with Syria following the victory of the country's government against terror. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Israeli forces have escalated their arrest campaigns throughout the occupied territories, detaining dozens of Palestinians in raids across the occupied West Bank early Monday. The Palestinian Prisoner Society revealed that the arrests were made mainly in Ain al-Sultan camp in Ariha, also known as Jericho, and Al-Jalazon refugee camp in Ramallah, as well as in a number of villages west of the city. The society accused Israel of trying to find different excuses to raid Palestinian areas. This time, the Israeli army announced that its forces operating in the West Bank were exposed to fire more than once by Palestinian resistance fighters.
The reasons behind arresting Palestinians this time are many and different, and the goal is to drain the energy of the Palestinian people, in which they won't resist Israel, the occupation. The Israeli tries through detention to convince the people that there is no way to achieve victory.
Israeli forces continue to storm Palestinian villages and cities on a daily basis under the excuse of arresting Palestinian activists. In the village of Qatani, northwest occupied Al-Quds, two Palestinians were shot and seriously wounded before they were detained.
These campaigns are part of Israeli oppression that aims at breaking the Palestinian resistance to occupation, but they will not succeed. And in my opinion, all these arrests reflect the crisis of the Israeli system that does not understand that Palestinians will never give up.
Palestinians warn that Israel's escalated crackdown against the activists and the use of excessive force is meant to fight the Palestinian resistance. They see the operations as a failed attempt to intimidate the youth into giving up resistance. Israel holds thousands of Palestinians, including women and minors, in jail. Israel intensifies its arrest campaigns against Palestinians under the pretext of a policy known as mowing the lawn, which is aimed at re-arresting Palestinian activists to prevent any forms of resistance. Experts say these detentions remain as part of Tel Aviv's perpetual war against the Palestinians. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
A hearty congratulations to all our listeners on the 43rd 10-day dawn celebrations marking the victory of the Islamic Revolution.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For thou art Allah, the best guardian, and thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps, and seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Israel has been using its vast support from the U.S. to find allies in the Middle East region. Days ago, Israeli President Isaac Herzog made his first visit to the UAE. The visit marks another step by the two sides to bolster ties despite concerns among regional countries. Well, Iran has raised the alarm about Israel's growing presence in the West Asian region, saying the regime poses a major threat to all regional countries. Bahrain also received the Israeli Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, in an official two-day visit. Bahrain was one of the regional states that normalized its relations with the Israeli regime via the Washington-mediated so-called Abraham Accords back in August 2020. Ever since, the island has been witnessing near daily popular protests against the deals, whose opponents say opens up the way for the Israeli regime's interference in the Persian Gulf region.
Some Arab countries have had clandestine relations with Israel for many years, despite claiming support for Palestinians and calling for the liberation of the occupied territories. But recently, these relations have become increasingly overt, and it seems they have nothing to be afraid of anymore to reveal their relations. In the latest developments, the Israeli regime's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, visited Manama on Thursday and met with Bahrain's king and other high-ranking officials. During the visit, the two sides signed a security cooperation agreement with Bahrain, the first such deal between Israel and a Persian Gulf Arab country. Gantz claims the agreement takes the bilateral relations to new heights and will contribute to the security of both Manama and Tel Aviv and the stability of the region.
It was not only a normal reception, but number one, it is the first time that any Gulf state has signed a defense agreement with the Zionists, with the occupiers of Palestine. Number two, that He was taken to all military establishments, especially the Americans, to boast of the military strength of the regime, that it can rely on the support of America and Israel.
Bahrain main opposition group Al-Wefaq slammed the move, saying any security or military agreement between the kingdom and Israel is unlawful and has no legitimacy. The group also blasted the visit by Gantz as crossing red lines. Analysts say not only political groups, but civil society groups in Bahrain consider Israel an enemy.
The people in Bahrain, with all their segments, whether opposition political societies that represent the popular majority, such as Al-Wefaq Society, and all civil society associations, consider Israel an enemy and reject any form of normalization with this enemy.
Palestinian resistance movement Hamas also strongly condemned the visit, saying the move emboldened the Israeli regime to commit more crimes. Israeli officials have made similar visits to a number of other Arab states, such as the United Arab Emirates, Sudan, and Morocco in the past couple of years to normalize ties with them. Bahrain, along with the UAE, normalized relations with Israel in 2020 under the so-called Abraham Accords through agreements brokered by the United States of America. Morocco and Sudan later signed similar U.S.-backed deals with the Israeli regime. Palestinians view the deals as a stab in their back and a betrayal of their cause of liberating their lands from Israel's decades-long occupation, leaving them with no other option but to rely on their resistance to free their territories and establish their own independent government.
Joining us on Tonight's Spotlight, we have activist and political analyst Leif Maarouf, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. And journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier, joining us from Brussels. Let's start off with Mr. Maarouf in the Lebanese capital. Sir, it's great to have you with us. More Persian Gulf Arab governments, they're expanding ties with the Israelis, but are these actions further putting the security of the region at risk?
Well, if you really look at these agreements, they're not going to change any much in the what's on the ground. This is Bahrain hosting the American Central Command fleet, the largest naval base basically for the United States in the most of the region, and if not the world outside the United States. And what are they going to bring with this treaty beyond open relations? These are relations that have been in existence between Bahrain and Qatar and the Emirates and the Saudis since the creation of the Zionist state in the closed doors, behind the closed doors, and they've financed against any revolutionary movements in the region, including the Arab Union movements led by Nasser, or the liberation movements in Syria and Lebanon and so forth. So nothing's really going to change, but the fact that now the Bahraini's population is going to be used as gun fodder for the Israeli, the Zionist colony, because in the next war, if Bahrain is involved in a war against Iran on the side of the Zionist colony, it is Bahrain that's going to be decimated in such war and taking those beatings on behalf of the Zionists.
Elijah Magnier, how do you view the repercussions of intelligence and military cooperation between the Israeli regime and the likes of the Bahrainis and the UAE? Does this undermine and threaten the security of the region? Just to recall, Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, recently told his Emirati counterpart that the presence of Israel in the region poses a threat to all regional countries.
Thank you for having me. I think since Israel joined the CENTCOM in Central Europe, the relationship between the Israeli military and the U.S. military has expanded and the bond is much stronger, which also justified the relationship between the U.S. and all the Arab and Gulf countries. Therefore, Israel used to be an abusive entity against its own population, and also plotting against Iran and the Axis of the Resistance and any other country that stands against the U.S. hegemony of the Middle East. And now what happens is have more ground to stand on in Bahrain, in the Emirates, and not surprisingly in Saudi Arabia, and they used to have in Egypt and Jordan. So the Israelis are expanding their presence. However, this is not going to change a lot of the Israeli performance, because there is already a rule of deterrence established between all the enemies of Israel and all the allies of Israel. I don't think there's much to be seen from the Israeli side in the future, apart from abusing of the wealth of the Gulf country that are very happy to welcome the Israelis. And also, there is a lot of similarity between what the Israelis are doing and what the Gulf countries are doing, particularly Bahrain in this case. So I think the Bahraini can learn a bit more from the Israelis, not only about security, but about how the cruel conditions of the prisoners in Israel, because we have exactly the same condition in Bahrain that were condemned by the U.S. House Committee a few months ago, talking about the arbitrary detention about political prisoner, about the restriction of freedom, all these inhuman conditions of people who oppose the Bahrain regime and ask for their freedom of expression. There's a lot of similarity of that in Israel against the Palestinians. So I think they complete each other.
Laith Maruf, let's not overlook the U.S.'s role in these normalization deals and the expansion of ties. What is Washington pursuing here, both in terms of the Israeli interests and in terms of its own regional motives?
Well, the Americans and before them the British were always trying to create, manufacture a good Arab, a good house Arab that they can market to their population as acceptable. And at the same time, this is what finally the Gulf countries are trying to provide to the Americans, because for a long time these Gulf countries were providing also on behalf of American decision making and CIA decisions the example of the bad Arab that was put in Hollywood, of the terrorists, of the Osama bin Ladens, of the Baghdadis, which is another service. So right now the Saudis and the Bahrainis and the Emiratis and the Qataris, what they are delivering to the American empire in value is that creation of this new propaganda that the good Arab is the one that accepts the rule of Zionist colonists and American hegemony over our land, over our holy lands, that the good Arab is the one that rules Mecca and Medina, the holiest cities of Islam, but allows the American to come into this land, or allows the Israelis to occupy Jerusalem. Obviously, when we talk about in Bahrain right now, the population of Bahrain is against this humiliation and defeat and subjugation of our people across the region. And that's true of all peoples of the Arab world. Much of them are not able to speak as openly as the people in Bahrain that are steadfast, that are out in the streets almost on a weekly basis, still, decade after the beginning of their rebellion against the Bahraini royal family. They're still coming out condemning this normalization with the Western colonizers on our lands.
Elijah Magnier, security assurances and guarantees have been highlighted as some of the motives behind these deals. Can these Arab countries rely on such promises from the U.S. and from the Israelis, and are these assurances viable in the long term?
Obviously, the Gulf countries, where there is no democracy, are trying to protect their kingdoms by relying on the Americans and trying to be friends with the Israelis, thinking that Israel can support them with the Americans and can protect, can help protecting their regime by offering new intelligence and new technology that can help the Gulf regimes to control and tighten the own citizens. So what we see is, what I understand from all of that, is a very fragile regimes who are trying to get more support from, more technological support and more support from Israel, the friend of the United States, to protect this fragile regime, because they don't think the lack of democracy at home can protect them enough, notwithstanding all the decades of ruling over a population that so far accepted the family to succeed one after the other, to pass on the power from father to son. And now, if the United States is talking about democracy and is saying that we are supporting the Gulf regime, this is a very clear contradiction with the principle of democracy in the West. Therefore, this regime can't hold unless they rely on illegal activity, on human rights abuses, on torture, and also learn from the Americans the lack of accountability. That is exactly what the Israelis also are doing and enjoying from whenever they wage war against all the neighboring countries. So I think there is a lot of fear behind that. That's why when we see the intelligence cooperation between the Gulf country and Israel, for what reason these Gulf countries are going to use it but against their own citizens?
Mr. Magni, I'm going to stay with you for a minute, because our guest in Beirut just mentioned in his previous comments Bahrain as being one of the regional states that normalized its relations with Israel via the Washington mediated deals back in August 2000. Ever since, the island has been witnessing near daily protests against the deal, with the protesters believing that such deals open up the way for the Israeli regime's interference in the Persian Gulf region. A lot of opposition from the people of these Gulf countries. Have these governments taken into consideration that these deals and pacts could actually backfire?
I don't think so, because the relationship with Israel is not new, as your guest rightly said. And this relationship goes back a decade with the Emirati, with the Qatar, and with the Bahraini monarchy. Therefore, I don't think the Israelis can offer more than the folkloric handshaking and pictures in front of the world, just to show that Israel is accepted by all these Arab regimes, while the enemy and the demonized country that is completely isolated today is the one that is refusing to accept the reality. So nothing is going to change, because the animosity between Iran and Israel is very obvious and it is public. Iran is supporting the axis of the resistance that is creating much more pain to Israel than the outcome and the benefit that is getting from the Arab state for its own security. So the only thing that the Israeli can get from the Gulf country is business deal and more money to be injected in Israel and boost whoever is going to be the prime minister of Israel. On the security level, yes, they can monitor more the communication, they can cause more havoc to these countries and the group that are against the Israeli. They can easily infiltrate, like example, Syria or Lebanon or Iraq, because they are Arabs and their access is more open than the access to the, of the Israelis to these countries. And that will not change, because already these countries were working for the Americans on the intelligence service level, and the Americans supporting the Israelis because they are very close allies. So I don't think a lot is going to be manifested out of this memorandum of agreement and the security exchange and support from Israel to Bahrain or the Emiratis or Qatar or the Saudi Arabia.
Laith Maruf, what about the stance that these Gulf countries are presenting to the Palestinians? Do you believe that these Arab governments have turned a blind eye effectively to the suffering of their Arab brethren?
Well, they've turned a blind eye since the beginning. And we're talking about, you know, these monarchies have been installed by the British, you know, crown before they left in the 1960s and 70s. When we talk about Bahrain, this is a ruling family that is not even from Bahrain. Similarly for Qatar, similarly for the United Arab Emirates, they are from Najd, and they were installed as agents to stop any revolutionary movements in the region. Because if you remember the 60s and 50s, and in the whole Arab world was decolonization revolutions, and the British rushed and installed these illegitimate and not indigenous monarchs over these Gulf countries to enforce continuous subjugation of the region and its resources. And so right now, when we look at what is the benefit for the Zionist colony and or the Americans, beyond just the media propaganda benefit for this move, it actually is a negative for the colonial project of Israel, because for 60, 70 years, these countries have been pretending to somehow care for the Palestinian cause, just so not to be a target of revolutionary activities against them in their land. And now they've burned their card, these Gulf monarchs, by stripping down naked in front of the Arab people as agents of destruction of the region on behalf of the Zionist colonists and the imperialists. They are now, you know, open to all attacks. There's nothing anymore that gives them legitimacy to stay.
All right, we're running short of time. One last question for Mr. Magnier. In the wake of these normalization deals, all Palestinian factions have been adamant that they will continue on with their resistance. Do you expect to see a more united Palestinian front in the face of these measures?
If President Mahmoud Abbas is removed from the presidency that he's holding for the last 15, 16 years, I think the Palestinians have shown solidarity against Israel and the will to fight back, to get back their land that has been stolen by the Israelis. Yes, we saw in the Sword of Jerusalem in the last fight how all of Palestine stood as one unity against the Israelis. And not only Jerusalem and Gaza, but that involves all the territory occupied since 1948. Yes, there is more unity among the Palestinians, more unity that is expressed by the Gulf countries with Israel is reflecting on more unity among the Palestinian groups willing to fight Israel and the axis of the resistance to hold on to this cause.
Very well. We're going to leave it there. Allow me to thank my guest, activist and political analyst Laith Maruf, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut, and journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier speaking to us from Brussels. Also, thanks to our viewers for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting.
The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. Or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
The variants' rapid spread, different vaccine strategies, and varying levels of immunity worldwide make the pandemic's future difficult to model, says David Adam, writer, in an article published under the heading, "Will Omicron End the Pandemic? Here's What Experts Say." Stay tuned for more. On January 11th, just 7 weeks after the Omicron variant was first reported, the World Health Organization, WHO, warned of a tidal wave of infection washing from west to east across the world. 50 of the 53 countries in Europe and Central Asia had reported cases of Omicron, said Hans-Henry Klug, the WHO's regional director for Europe. Countries would have to cope as best they could, he said, guided by their individual epidemiological situation, available resources, vaccination uptake status, and socioeconomic context. In recent weeks, countries in Europe and the United States have felt the full force of Omicron wave. In the UK, which has reported most infections, daily COVID-19 cases peaked at more than 160,000 earlier this month. Scientists there say all nations are facing the same major problem: the sheer speed at which the variant spreads. And although the WHO and others have suggested that huge numbers of Omicron infections could signal the end of the pandemic because of the short-term surge in immunity that will follow, researchers warn that the situation remains volatile and difficult to model. It moves so fast that it gives very little time to prepare any kind of response, so decisions have to be made under huge uncertainty, says Graham Medley, an infectious diseases modeler at London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, who advises the UK government. Numbers of Omicron infections can double in less than 2 days, which is significantly faster than previous SARS-CoV-2 variants and closer to what public health officials would expect from the milder influenza virus. One scientist says Omicron is flu on acid. We haven't seen that speed before, and it meant you couldn't vax your way out of it, adds Christina Pagel, a healthcare data analyst at University College London, adding, even if you could vax everybody, it still takes 2 weeks for the vaccine to kick in, and by then you are in the middle of it. That places policymakers and researchers who advise them in an unenviable position. It was a situation where you either put it in restrictions very, very early or you do nothing, Pagel says, adding, but if you wait to see what happens, then it's too late. Along with other countries, Britain tightened regulations in December, but it was a controversial move, particularly because reports from South Africa, which was hit by Omicron the previous month, suggested that the variant seemed to cause less severe illness and hospitalization, a conclusion now supported by the experience of the UK and other places. UK modelers were initially torn about how to use information from South Africa. It's relatively straightforward to update a computer model to account for changes in the biological properties of a new variant. However, as the pandemic has progressed, it has become much harder to simulate the baseline immune response of a country's population and so to judge how that will limit spread. In the early days of the pandemic, researchers could assume that most people worldwide were equally susceptible to infection because COVID-19 was a new disease and no vaccines were available. But 12 months of different vaccine strategies, types, and take-up rates from country to country, as well as fluctuating rates of infection and recovery, have left a diverse immunological landscape. The probability that infection will put someone in hospital is absolutely a key parameter, but we are now estimating that in an obviously not naive population, says Mark Woolhouse, an infectious disease epidemiologist at the University of Edinburgh, UK, who also advises the government, adding, when you are making those sorts of estimates, formally you really should remake them for every population you're interested in, and that applies everywhere. Modelers were confounded by the lack of specifics in South African data about reduced severity. There was no quantitative analysis, Woolhouse says, adding, so what numbers do you plug in? Are you saying 10% less pathogenic, or 50% less, or 90% less? Still speaking in a personal capacity, Woolhouse says that some influential modelers in the UK were wrong not to allow for any reduced severity, instead working with assumed hospitalization rates for Omicron that were identical to those of previous variants. That's clearly a pessimistic assumption, he says, adding, I do not think it could have been much clearer from the beginning that there was this possibility it was less pathogenic, and, you know, being crystal clear on what the policy implications of that difference might be. The heterogeneity in immunological baselines and other important factors such as population dynamics from country to country make it difficult to predict international spread of Omicron with any precision, or to assess, for example, how the variant might take hold in countries with lower vaccination rates. It's very hard to answer that question, says Julian Tang, a consultant virologist at the Leicester Royal Infirmary, UK. And it's not very useful because if you say it's spreading in pattern X, Y, Z across Western Europe and then ABC across North America and M and O in Africa, that doesn't really help anybody. The waning protection against infection that vaccines offer against Omicron also complicates the picture. Lab studies have indicated that inactivated virus vaccines, which make up almost half of the 10 billion doses distributed worldwide, elicit few antibodies against the variant. Does that mean that Omicron will rip through places that rely on these shots even faster? Not necessarily, says Woolhouse. The inactivated virus vaccines might induce a broader immunity that would react to a wider range of strains because it will elicit immune responses against viral proteins other than spike, which is particularly variable, he says. It's a very interesting question, but I simply haven't seen a formal analysis of it yet. That's because there are few real-world data to go on. It's only just hitting countries that have used them, says Pagel. Among the countries that rely on inactivated virus vaccines, Omicron seems to be making the most headway in the Philippines, which saw an exponential rise in COVID-19 cases this month, particularly in Manila. The number of new infections in the capital does not seem to be dropping, but the virus is spreading farther afield. Definitely cases are slowing down in the national capital region, but in other regions it is now increasing, said Maria Rosario Veregui, health spokesperson for the Philippines government. Vaccination rates are still relatively low in the Philippines, with 53% of the population fully vaccinated. Officials dare say they want to vaccinate all the country's 77 million adults by May. Although vaccines are likely to continue protecting against severe symptoms, Pagel says, infection will continue to spread, adding, I think the assumption is that none of the vaccines are going to give you long-lasting protection against infection. Tang agrees, saying, I don't think vaccines are the way this pandemic is going to end. So how will it end? Not with Omicron, researchers predict. This will not be the last variant, and so the next variant will have its own characteristics, Medley says. Given that the virus is unlikely to disappear completely, COVID-19 will inevitably become an endemic disease, scientists say. But that's a slippery concept, and one that means different things to different people. I think it's the expectation that the general behavior is somehow towards the situation where we have so much immunity in the population that we would no longer see very deadly epidemics, says Sebastian Funk, an epidemiologist at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. The transition to endemicity, or living with the virus without restrictions and safeguards, is difficult to model with any accuracy, he adds. That's partly because even the best disease models struggle to make sensible forecasts beyond a few weeks ahead. It's also because endemicity reflects a judgment call on how many deaths societies are willing to tolerate while the global population steadily builds up immunity. For Woolhouse, COVID-19 will truly become endemic only when more adults are protected against severe infection because they have been exposed multiple times to the virus as children and so have developed natural immunity. That will take decades, and it means many older people today who were not exposed as children will remain vulnerable and might need continued vaccinations. That strategy has its flaws. Some of those exposed as children will develop long COVID. And it relies on children continuing to show much lower rates of severe illness as variants evolve. There are no guarantees that the next variant will be milder. But Tang says That seems to be the pattern so far. He says this virus is getting milder and milder with each iteration.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.